WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Has it been a week already? Well, you know what we do around here when we get to Friday. We get ready for our weekly news recap. That's when we cover the top stories that you need to know about. From new lawsuits alleging abuse at Illinois juvenile detention centers.
200 have come forward to sue the state and the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice that operates Illinois youth centers, many of which are around Chicago.
To concerns about how Chicago's preparing for the Democratic National Convention.
There are questions on whether Chicago police are ready after mistakes were made during the George Floyd protests.
We broke down these stories and more with a panel of journalists. Melody Mercado is a reporter covering the Loop, West Loop, River North, and the Gold Coast for Block Club Chicago. Brandis Friedman is an anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Plus Mitch Armantrout, government and politics reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. In the news this week, Chicago's got hundreds of millions of dollars in COVID relief funds that it's got to spend before the end of the year. So we start our recap there, and I asked Mitch about what plans Mayor Johnson presented to the city council for how to make the most of that pot of money. Here's Mitch.
So basically, the city was granted about $2 billion from the federal government, sort of when the COVID pandemic was really just wrecking government's bottom lines across the nation. Under the terms of that grant from the government, the federal government, the city has to spend those dollars by the end of 2026. But also, the way those funds are distributed, the city has to spend about $200 million, or at least earmark it, by the end of this year. So Mayor Brandon Johnson's proposal to use for a good chunk of that change is to direct it towards guaranteed income pilot programs that the city's been, and similar programs have been, a similar program at the county level has been in effect for a couple of years now. But about $31 million of that $200 million chunk of change, the mayor is hoping to extend that program for city residents. You know, it's $500 monthly payments, no strings attached. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks who've received those, you know, they see it as just a way of helping stay afloat.
Yeah, they help.
It's you know, there hasn't been a lot of academic research on it yet, but, you know, just reporting from our newspaper and WBEZ and authors, you know, folks who are receiving that money viewed it as a critical lifeline.
Well, how are the alders reacting to Johnson's plans for this money?
There's the progressive alders who, you know, have sided with Johnson on a lot of his policy proposals are excited to see that money, mm-hmm. to keep it going that way. Others say that, you know, some of those dollars should have been directed towards things like maybe the CTA to help improve cleanup on trains and to try and bring ridership back up to pre-pandemic levels. But for the most part, you know, we expect to see those funds directed the way the mayor wants.
And Alderman Jason Irvin, it's reported in the Sun-Times, one of his complaints is rather than just handing people money, cash, $500 monthly, he would rather see an investment into sort of a job training program or something of the like. And I think, you know, I think supporters of it say it's not, you know, it's not an either or, it's a both and, right? Like we can give folks this
right.
money monthly and, you know, support them and still get them job training. And at the end of a year, maybe they are better prepared for a job and not deeper in debt or, you know, struggling with other issues because they couldn't pay a hospital bill or buy gas to get to work.
Right. Some alders have called for really more oversight of how the city spends this federal aid. So did that come up again?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Alderman Bill Conway, who has really positioned himself as sort of the voice of fiscal responsibility, a little bit farther, not to say that he's a Republican by any means, but a little bit farther right on the Democratic spectrum in the city council. He wants to see a much tighter city council control of where these dollars are going. And, you know, like I said, it looks like Mayor Johnson will be able to get what he wants, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
interesting.
A matter of discussion at next week's council meeting.
Yeah, well, yesterday, it was the last day of school here in Chicago. Yay. I'm thrilled. They're on my couch right now doing nothing. No, with teens having more time on their hands, though, one Alder's calling for an 8 p.m. curfew. This is coming after a Streeterville couple was attacked by two teens, Melody. So I want to start with whatever you can share from that incident first. Mm-hmm.
So police say that last Friday, around 8:30, 9 o'clock, a couple was attacked by 14 and 17-year-old. The man was punched in the head, and the woman's hair was pulled, had some hair pulled out. They said they responded to the scene. They did arrest the two teens, charged them with misdemeanors, treated the couple at the scene, and they declined to be taken to the hospital. Following that, they did an interview with Fox 32 in Chicago where they allegedly shared more details about the attack anonymously during mm-hmm. the interview. And Alderman Brian Hopkins, who represents the Second Ward.
Yeah. He's proposing?
Yeah, he's proposing an 8 p.m. curfew just for the Central Business District. And for those that don't know where that area is, it's basically the Loop, Streeterville, River North, part of the West Loop Gate neighborhood, and to sort of rein in what he's saying is like uncontrollable teens that are taking over downtown mm-hmm. and causing havoc and all of these things.
So currently, Melody, there's a 10 p.m. curfew, as we know, for everybody yes. that's under 17. Mm-hmm. Does the city actually enforce that curfew? From what you know?
You know, we did Block Club did an investigation into the first couple months of this curfew, which was pushed up 1 hour in 2022 by former Mayor Lori Lightfoot. And we found that it wasn't very widely implemented. It's also mostly implemented on the south and west sides. And there was little to no change in crime during that time either.
So can you be ticketed for being out after curfew, or do your parents get ticketed? What actually happens?
Right. So it's basically they pick the kids up. They take them home. If the parents home, they can ticket them. But it's mostly, you know, Mayor Lightfoot at the time said, it's not our goal to give these kids tickets or to punish their parents, but they need to know like where they are. And if they're out past curfew, our job is to bring them home, let the parents know what they were up to, and hopefully it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Mitch and Brandis, I mean, this curfew controversy comes up, I feel, every summer. Right? Headlines we've heard in the past about quote unquote teen takeovers in downtown in past summers. Like, is this just a thing now we just can't get rid of?
Well, I mean, I think it points to a bigger problem that has not been addressed. So, yeah, we're not going to get rid of it until we address the bigger problem, right? Which is, and Mayor Lightfoot said as much, I think it was last summer or whenever it was, just kind of pointing to the need for some more constructive activity for teens, right? You know, there are some teens who maybe come downtown and maybe they do have tickets to something. But some are just, you know, looking for some activity, looking for fun, for something to do.
Hanging around.
They're just hanging around. Clearly, there are some who do find themselves or do create a violent situation, and that needs to be addressed by other means as well. And I thought when Mayor Lightfoot brought this up, she said, we're going to start engaging on meaningful ways and activities for these teens to know that they are welcome downtown as yeah. well, but with something to do,
yeah,
something
like,
in particular.
I mean, some do have jobs downtown. I think mine are mm-hmm. working on some internships right now that will actually bring them downtown as well. So I'm
exactly.
hoping they don't get caught in the mix of, you know, being thought to be doing, you know, wrongdoing. But I mean, how much support, Mitch, do you think that there might be in the city council for an earlier curfew?
It's hard to see, certainly Mayor Brandon Johnson, it's hard to see him supporting a measure like this. And I wouldn't expect a lot of his more progressive allies in the council to support it.
I think
it.
The 42nd Ward, Alderman Riley, has already sort of expressed that he supports
right.
it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. His ward kind of borders right up against it. And obviously, you know, for residents in those downtown areas, you know, this is a big concern for them. But it's just hard to imagine a bigger support from the city council. You know, Mayor Johnson, like you were saying, Brandis, one of his biggest initiatives is increasing youth hiring in park district programs.
That's right.
And he's really made it a priority, or it's a stated priority of his to, you know, increase programming for kids in different parts of the city to sort of, you know, spread out activities and give kids different places to go, especially in parts of the city on the south and west sides where there's just not many resources for, you know, to give kids something to do.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a difference too, that one summer Chicago, I'm seeing access to programs that I wasn't seeing for my girls last year.
And I think for one summer Chicago, I think they've actually increased the number of job opportunities that are available.
Same thing with After School Matters.
People. Exactly.
Yeah.
But even then, it's a fraction. It's not nearly as much as by the number of applications that they get for these activities. Right. So, you know, they've got some growth there. I can see where it might be difficult. But I think also research has shown that, you know, certain, you know, you can make that curfew as early as you want. It might not have an actual impact on public safety. So I'm not sure there's going to be a whole lot of appetite.
8 p.m. is pretty early.
That's early.
Very early.
I feel like
early.
It's a big ask, right? Like,
it is.
I mean,
8 o'clock, got to catch the train home.
One of my daughters went to Six Flags yesterday because it's a thing that they do on the last day of school is, I guess, you know, you ditch and you do something else. You go to the beach or what have you. And her crew went to Six Flags. And I mean, I was quite upset, but she got home at like 9:30. And I was like,
late.
Mama's got to work tomorrow. She's got the recap.
I need you to be in the house.
So we're going to stick with teens, Mitch. There's a tragic story if these allegations are true. More than 100 people filed two new lawsuits against the state, the Department of Corrections and the Department of Juvenile Justice. What's happening?
These are lawsuits that are really tough to read, really disturbing allegations from many people who are now adults who were held in juvenile justice centers across the state, 8 different centers, mostly in the Chicago area, including one on the near north side. Basically from folks who allege that while they were held there, they were sexually abused or otherwise mistreated by staff, including correctional officers and even delivery drivers are among the folks who are accused in this lawsuit. You know, it's we saw a similar lawsuit filed last month. We've seen lawsuits filed in other states. You know, it's just really disturbing material. We're talking about some of the most vulnerable members of society, really, here, who are at the mercy of folks who are supposed to be taking care of them in justice centers. State officials have not commented directly on this latest lawsuit in the Chicago area, but, you know, they say that they take all allegations of misconduct seriously. But, you know, it just raises more questions in a state where the Department of Child and Family Services is just really, over the years, a lot of cases of just mistreatment by officials. And, you know, it's another area where Governor Pritzker is, you know, he's stated that he's trying to clean up these things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's still a lot more work to be done.
Yeah, Brandis, this lawsuit, I think it makes it sound like there is a true problem in the juvenile justice system.
It's heartbreaking, right? And I didn't read the lawsuits themselves, but, you know, based on my colleague Matt Masterson's writing, you know, there's, I don't want to get too far into it in the middle of the day, right? But, you know, young, you know, 14-year-old girls being asked to go topless, you know, and being groped by a delivery driver or, you know, being sexually abused after earning, quote, extra time if you do a little bit of extra cleaning.
So it's
very disturbing.
Disturbing.
Yeah, it's said to have happened. The plaintiffs are ages on this most recent lawsuit, 10 to 17 years old, and happening, you know, around the state, 95 men, 13 women filing suit from 1997 to 2019. So a long time period, which, I mean, and the lawsuit, you know, alleges that that the department, IDOC and IDJJ allowing juvenile justice, allowing sort of a culture of this kind of sexual abuse to go unchecked, which is devastating.
Oh, for sure. Well, before we take a quick break, we've all heard about catalytic converter theft, but this time it involved a Jesuit priest. So you covered this one, Melody?
Yes.
Tell us more.
Father Jeremiah Lynch, who is staying in sort of like these apartments are available for those in the priesthood in the city. That's connected to St. Ignatius High School. He heard something going on outside, some shifting around. He walked outside to check it out, and there were two men trying to steal a Cadillac converter from one of the cars parked near the private Catholic school. And so when those two individuals saw him, they pointed a gun at him and shot in his direction. He was grazed by the bullet in his head, and a bullet also went through one of the residence's doors. And he's doing okay as far as we've heard. But this
Do we have an update on his condition?
Not most recently, but when the story ran, we had heard he was doing well.
Okay.
And it's just like one of those things where you don't think it's going to happen to you, and all of a sudden you're faced with a situation like that.
Oh, absolutely. And you being sort of a witness, right?
You're right.
Coming in, it makes you wonder, like in real life, if this was you, like, would you say something? Would you pretend you didn't see anything? Because you could get hurt just by being caught up in the middle of this.
It also seems very brazen, right? Thieves typically want to steal their stuff and get away. But to be called on it and to just open fire, that's strong arm, right?
Like the fact that he was just grazed by the bullet.
That could have been so much worse.
My goodness.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't.
Yeah, we'll definitely hold him in our thoughts.
The Chicago Police Department revealed more of its security plans for the upcoming Democratic National Convention. On Monday, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling spoke at a joint news conference with the Secret Service. They'll be handling security inside the convention, while Chicago Police will be in charge of what happens outside the United Center. Melody, were there any changes in CPD's strategy?
I think the largest thing here is that CPD is revealing more than what it has in the past, and mostly in terms of we're training thousands of officers to make sure that they are aware of First Amendment rights, and that we have this new mass arrest policy that we're going to make sure that everybody's trained up on and it ready for the protests that will inevitably happen at the DNC. I will say the thing that really stood out for me the most was sort of the change in Superintendent Snelling's messaging.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, he had consistently said, as long as people are peacefully protesting and not acting out violently or looting, then, you know, their First Amendment right will be protected. But during this week's press conference, he changed that a little bit and said, well, not all peaceful protests are protected under the First Amendment. And I will say that it was a very big change as to what I've heard in the past. And because we have heard groups that are not currently permitted and are suing the city and federal court saying, we plan to protest peacefully with or without permits. And now with these new comments from Snelling, we have these groups a little bit concerned about, okay, so we will be there, we will be protesting, we're not trying to cause any problems, but does this mean that we're all going to get arrested? Does this mean that we're going to see violence on the side of CPD? And that's been a large concern.
Let's hear from Snelling himself.
Even if it's not an act of violence and it appears peaceful, but it's a violation of the law, blocking roadways, blocking venues, things of that nature, we will declare mass arrests in those situations and make those arrests.
Do you think Superintendent Snelling's warning will have any impact on demonstrations, Brandis? Mitch?
You know, I think no matter what, there's going to be tens of thousands of folks descending on Chicago to make their voices heard. And, you know, I wonder if sort of this, I don't want to call it a softening of the city's stance, but, you know, sort of trying to make some sort of concession to the protesters, or at least this segment of protesters. I wonder if that comes with a nudge from Mayor Johnson, who for most of his career was the one in these types of demonstrations. And obviously, you know, that this is putting Chicago on the biggest stage. Mayor Johnson needs this to go as smoothly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there's no stopping the mass, the major demonstrations.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Brandis?
I don't think that that they're going to roll it back at all, right? Yeah. I think they're going to charge ahead and you know, come what may, right? Because they believe that the police department is wrong, and they would rather take their opportunity and exercise what they believe to be their right wherever it is, and let's deal with it in the court afterwards if they need to. The other thing that I just wanted to bring up is, and you may have talked about this, you know, over the week or last week, we heard from the city's Inspector General Deborah Witzberg on Chicago Tonight earlier this
Absolutely.
Week as well,
yeah.
You know, saying, yes, the department has made some gains with its ability to handle sort of like these, you know, large gathering situations. But, you know, she still has, you know, some concerns, including one thing we just heard Snelling say. He's talking about the mass arrest policy, which is still in the works, right? He says that people are being trained on it. But Deborah Witzberg points out that can lead to a little bit of confusion mm-hmm. if it hasn't been finalized yet, but you're already training people on it. And also the question could, I mean, the public could kind of question how much their feedback
yeah.
because of the public comment period, you know, how much that's actually been, you know, taken in and absorbed and worked into the policy that's coming out. So I'll be
right.
really, you know, curious to see how this works out over the next couple of months, of course.
For sure. Yeah. We talked about this on Reset. We had a criminal justice reporter sort of break down Deborah Witzberg's concerns. You know, her report highlighted concerns that CPD's crowd control policies included outdated concepts and lacked public input. Melody, what has Superintendent Snelling said in response to those concerns?
Included in that report was a letter from Superintendent Snelling kind of going point by point defending the Chicago Police Department mm-hmm. And their new policy, and pretty much saying that the IG's office relied heavily on paperwork material describing the policy and the trainings instead of actually coming in person to see them. And, you know, I did ask him this week if he plans on making any changes to the policy leading up to the DNC, given we're so close. He didn't commit to making no changes because
okay.
he said, you know, although he's very happy with the policy, if we see something that needs to be changed, we will change it. But I think, again, that highlights the concern from the IG's office is if you're about to change something with less than 2 months to go and you're training 3,000 officers, mm-hmm. how are you going to get that point across?
What was that whole back and forth about kettling versus encircling the protesters? And like, is there a difference?
Well,
it depends on who you ask.
It depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
From covering multiple protests, encirclement, kettling is when police officers encircle protesters, kind of trapping them, and then they give these orders to leave, but there's nowhere for these protesters to go
right.
because they're surrounded by police officers
right.
and then they get arrested.
I think his distinction was like one involves like when you target a specific group that is doing or maybe causing trouble versus like just like a large just casting a large web.
You know. Well, and Witzberg, you know, she called that action into question as well, because it would seem to me, and I'm no expert, obviously, that's a bit of an escalation, right? Because I can imagine
oh,
if
surely.
I'm among a group of protesters and suddenly we're, you know, encircled by the cops, how am I going to react?
Exactly.
How are the protesters right. going to react to that?
Yeah. Right. Interesting discussion here. Let's stick with police here, Mitch. Four Chicago officers face dismissal. This is for allegedly stealing cash and drugs and lying about gun seizures. What?
It's kind of a confusing case involving these four tactical officers. All these cases stem from a series of arrests and non-arrests made by officers Daniel Fair, Jeffrey Morrow, Kevin Taylor, and Rupert Collins. My colleagues, Tom Shuba and Frank Mann at the Sun-Times, have really been digging into these cases. You know, one of them is sort of a clear-cut case, or appears to be a clear-cut case of officer misconduct. A car is stopped, a bag of drugs and a big stack of cash go missing.
Mm-hmm.
The arrest is made, but none of the cash and the drugs aren't inventoried. That's the allegation that the Civilian Office of Police Accountability has made against these officers. I should say that all these officers, they deny any wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is sort of raising more curiosity in these cases is these officers essentially stopped several different folks at different times with guns, you know, guns that were held illegally in most of these cases.
Right.
And the officers ended up inventorying these weapons, but they didn't arrest any of the folks who were stopped with them. And the investigation from the Civilian Office of Police Accountability found that one of these people who was stopped with the weapon had the officers properly, run the background on the weapon that they found, this guy was wanted for murder in Kentucky.
Wow.
So it's hard to say what the motivation behind that might be. You know, when you talk about a stack of money and a bag of drugs, like, okay, maybe we've got a case of some officers trying to cash in on the job. Again, allegations. But it's as far as the gun seizures, it's raising questions about, you know, officers who are really being pushed from above to take as many guns off the street as possible. Potentially in these cases without making arrests and pressing charges. You know, those are that's a process that can take hours and days and take officers off the street.
And the superintendent says he's settling in motion the process of firing.
Exactly, yeah. So this has been under investigation. This actually caught the attention of the FBI last year. And now Superintendent Snelling is putting the firing procedure into motion. Again, that can take months or years to play out. And just important to note that these officers deny any wrongdoing here. But we'll see how those disciplinary cases play out.
Now, while we here are gearing up for a presidential election, Mexico just had theirs. It was historic for a couple of reasons. Not only did they elect their first female president, but the first time ever, Mexican nationals who were living here in the U.S. were able to vote in person at their local consulate. How was the turnout here in Chicago, Melody?
It was very large. Yeah. The line wrapped around the block from the consulate, and I don't think that based on reporting and just seeing photos, it doesn't seem like the Mexican consulate was very prepared for that. Mm. Even though there were several immigrant rights activists that had reached out and said, hey, people are going to turn out for this election. You guys better be prepared. And it took a couple hours to get through 400 people. Wow. And I believe there were either around 1,300 or 1,500 people that had registered ahead of time. Mm-hmm. In addition to, there were extra ballots for people that did not pre-register but did have a valid voter's ID card from Mexico. They were allowed to sort of walk in.
So did they make the voting process at least easy, despite the long lines and the crowds?
It still seems like people still spent a lot of time in line. It seemed like people were excited to be involved in the process, but they brought their lawn chairs, they brought snacks, like they were prepared. and at the end of the day, voting for them was really important, and we saw that with the show out of people.
Oh my goodness, yeah, the city of Chicago shut down Ashland Avenue from Ogden Avenue to Jackson Boulevard to accommodate the crowds. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. And lots of people did end up not being able to vote in the end, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I think the Mexican consulate should have been better prepared. I mean, in Chicago, one in five people are identify as being Latino, majority of those Mexican. So I think there's no surprise here, but would have liked to see some better organization.
Mm-hmm. Next time.
Next time.
Before we take a break, we meant to get to this last week, Brandis, but we didn't have enough time. A right-wing organization is suing Evanston for its first-in-the-nation government-funded reparations program. What is the legal argument in this lawsuit?
Sorry, I'm snickering. I didn't mean to do that. So, yes, it is filed by an organization, I think they're based out of D.C., called Judicial Watch. And they, you know, acknowledge that they are a conservative organization that files a lot of lawsuits.
Okay.
Their argument in this instance, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm trying to get it right, but I have two words of what I think they're actually getting at. Basically saying that because the reparations law in Evanston doles out $25,000 based on race, it is a violation of the 14th Amendment. The Equal Protection Clause. That's basically what some folks might call reverse racism, that if you were using this to give money to only black people, that is a violation of the Constitution.
Okay.
That's the short version.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the key issues in this lawsuit is who is eligible for the $25,000 payments. How exactly does Evanston decide who gets reparations?
Yeah, so it is based on people, Evanston residents, who were either residents in between a certain number of years, 1919 to 1969, or descendants of residents or descendants of Evanstonians who were residents in those years. And obviously, you have to be over a certain age, et cetera. Initially, you could apply and be given the $25,000 to be used for, you know, home repairs, late or interest payments, you know, to the city if you owe money on a home that you own, or, you know, a down payment towards home, towards buying a home, you know, with the intention being that Evanston acknowledged that its housing segregation was racist during that particular time period, you know, using, you know, racial covenants, redlining, et cetera, that we all know about, and trying to right that wrong. But this group alleges that because people who are recipients of this money, they, and I should say they expanded it later on to just make it $25,000 cash payments to people with the same requirements.
Okay.
This group is arguing that because those people do not have to prove that they were discriminated against, and that and because they are black, that this is unconstitutional, and they are asking for an injunction against this law, of course, but also that the plaintiffs be paid, and anyone else who could be a party to the plaintiffs in the class, I guess, all be paid $25,000. That's what we know.
So what has Evanston's response been to this lawsuit? Have we heard anything?
We have not. And I think probably because they are now under lawsuit and they probably can't talk about it a whole lot. I think they've said something very simple, like, you know, we'll defend our, you know, defend this our legislation, right? We'll defend our ordinance that allows us to do this. And we're proud of our legislation that, you know, first in the nation and probably being modeled by other folks. That's, I mean, and we, I should mention, you know, we had one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs, Christine Svensson, on the show earlier this week, along with a representative, not a representative, but a professor, legal professor at Howard University, who's worked on pieces of legislation like this to defend it. Because one of their other, let me know when you need me to stop.
No.
One of their other arguments is that it is unfair for, you know, taxpaying residents of Evanston, for their taxpaying dollars to be used to give money to only a certain group of people on the basis of race, to which our other panelists responded, well, you know, our our taxes pay for lots of things that we didn't necessarily decide on.
That is correct.
And that's how the government works. One of their other arguments is that, you know, it's not necessarily the government's responsibility to fix this, you know, to sort of write this.
Messy.
Mm-hmm.
Messy.
Mm-hmm, a little bit.
Well, it seems we've reached the disgraced politicians section of the recap. Mitch, former Alderman Ed Burke was in court again this week. What is the latest on him?
Ed Burke, convicted last winter on a series of racketeering and attempted extortion charges.
Mm-hmm.
He's awaiting sentencing, which is expected to be handed down by a federal judge later
this
month.
When is that happening?
Believe it's the final week of June.
Okay.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, Brandis. But earlier this week, Mr. Burke and his attorneys were basically making sort of a Hail Mary attempt to try and get a judge to toss at least some of his convictions. Interestingly, his legal team didn't really challenge any of his charges related to, or I should say his convictions related to shaking down the owner of a franchisee of a Burger King on the Southwest side. Basically, he was convicted of trying to strong arm the franchisee into using his property tax appeal firm in exchange for speeding up his zoning approval. So, you know, The hearing that my colleague John Seidel covered in federal court earlier this week, you know, this is something that all folks who are, you know, the vast majority of folks who are convicted of crimes, you know, the last judges to reconsider, you know, the convictions, the arguments that, you know, the jury might not have been, didn't read their instructions correctly. So it's not expected that any of these will be overturned, but you never know, especially when it comes to Ed Burke. I mean, he's been around for, you know, probably all of our lifetimes combined at this point.
probably.
And, you know, he's facing, for some of the charges, they carry, you know, possible maximum sentences of 10 to 20 years. We're talking about an 80-year-old former alderman. So, you know, it could amount to essentially a lifetime sentence, but we'll see where the judge lands.
I mean, how likely do you think it is that he could get a new trial?
It's it seems unlikely, very unlikely to say the least. But, you know, judges have shown a pretty wide disparity in the sorts of sentences we've seen for elected officials. You know, there's been a parade of them over the last five or so years here in Chicago. So that really is, it'll be interesting to see. Prosecutors are expected to make their recommendation to the judge next week on what they want to see, what type of sentence they want to see.
I wonder how much time in prison they think he should be looking at.
You would have to think that they're eyeing at least, the upper end of a lot of those for the maximum sentence. For some of those, you know, we're talking about sort of the poster boy for Chicago corruption.
Yeah.
And federal prosecutors really want to put that trophy on the wall to try and deter other folks in a state that's really got a pretty nasty reputation for corruption.
All right, corruption corner on the recap is officially over. We're going to switch now to sports. The Cubs swept the Sox in the Crosstown Classic this week. That means the Southside franchise is tying its record for the longest losing streak in a single season. Oh, man, 13 games in a row.
Ouch.
Yeah, I have tickets to a game later this month. I guess that's why they were kind of giving them away. CPS was offering $5 tickets. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is
$5.
So generous. This is so generous.
No, that's
so
a pretty
nice
good deal. I still might buy a pair.
That's sweet.
It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Hopefully it turns around by then, the streak. Meanwhile, baseball stats made headlines for another reason this week involving the historic Negro Leagues, Brandis. Fill us in.
Yeah, that's right. And they actually, I think they did this last week and we were finally catching up on it this week. So, dirty secret of how news works, everybody. But So what Major League Baseball did, and they started this process about 4 years ago, which was adding the stats of the Negro Leagues baseball players in with the existing Major League Baseball stats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it got a little bit complicated because of the way the stats were kept for the individual teams. And so I think they had to do a lot of math, which sounds complicated.
Yes.
And so, but what they did, after everything was sort of counted up the way it needed to be, it made Josh Gibson the league's career leader. Sorry, with a 372 batting average. I think I'm saying that correctly. Surpassing Ty Cobb.
He's an all-time batting champ.
Yes, yes. And he also surpassed Babe Ruth in what is it? Slugging average. Sports ball, everybody. But the point is this. the point is this. You know, it is Major League Baseball says that they are correcting, you know, a longstanding oversight because I think they sort of looked into bringing in some other leagues back in the late 60s, but the Negro Leagues were left out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it elevates all of these players and, you know, it puts what, like 35 of them now, I think, in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And sort of giving them their due. Very few of them are still remaining, but I think it also lets folks know that, you know, because they were the Negro League, they were sometimes considered inferior.
Yes.
And this makes it clear they were never inferior. They
and that's
were just
so
separated.
Unfortunate,
they were just
too.
Segregated.
Yeah. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned the historical changes, like what's happening with Josh Gibson. I recently talked with Negro Leagues Baseball Museum co-founder Larry Lester. He told us about a couple other ball players who got some recognition.
Oscar Charleston, John Henry Pop Loy. They all played with Chicago, other Chicago Hall of Famers like pitcher Jose Mendez and Satchel Paige and the great Cuban, who they often called the Black Babe Ruth, Cristobal Torriente, Willie the Devil Wells, Smokey Joe Williams, Mule Suttles and Turkey Stearns, Pete Hill. They all played for Chicago-based teams.
Yeah, say their names.
Right, and these are all names that, how many of us have heard their names, right?
Correct,
we don't
exactly.
Know them. We don't know
long
them.
Long overdue acknowledgement, for sure. Melody, the Chicago Tribune is coming under fire for an editorial involving a player for the Chicago Sky. Can you lay out the Trib's argument and then what the criticism is?
Yes. So, the Chicago Tribune editorial board decided to release an editorial basically condemning Chicago Sky's Chenity Carter for a foul against Caitlin Clark, who is a rookie in the league. She came from University of Iowa. She was number one in the WNBA draft pick.
Mm-hmm.
She said that a foul that Carter did should be labeled as assault.
Yeah.
if the Chicago editorial board has never seen professional sports, a WNBA before, like, just say that. This was probably something that could
tell me you don't watch sports without telling me you don't watch sports.
Like, wow. I think everyone collectively gasped. I know I did when I read that. Because to label a foul like that assault has a lot of layers to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to shout out the Tribe and editor-in-chief Stephanie Walden, who did just a really good job articulating a response to that editorial, which said a lot of things I feel like we were all thinking. Mm-hmm. She kind of points out how Caitlin Clark is sort of being hailed this white savior of the WNBA, which is a majority black league. And she talked about a lot of the decorated WNBA players that put the league on the map and that have poured and shaped the league into mm-hmm. what it is today. And she also pointed out that Angel Reese, also rookie this year, ranked mm-hmm. one right now by USA Today, by the way, I will say that.
And here playing for us.
Yes,
on
here
our team.
Playing on Chicago Sky. Was chokeslammed. At a game.
Literally, like last week or
yes,
something.
Yes, I saw that and I was like, okay, Chicago editorial board, where is your comment
like
on that?
That was an assault?
Like, what is that?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and I just want to say, like, we've all seen clips of Caitlin Clark playing in the Big Ten, and you know, she's not a darling, you know? I've seen the fouls.
She does her
she
own
She knows how to play.
Shove. Right?
She exactly. knows how to play. We don't need to be coddling her. She's a professional athlete. And she's playing like one, and so is everybody else in the league. So I think a lot of people thought that this editorial was like really out of left field.
Yeah, and out of touch.
Yeah, and out of touch.
Have you all been following any of this discourse that's been happening with surrounding Caitlin Clark, and your thoughts on whether there is a double standard here? Because, you know, as women, and this is something that Tiffany brings up in her piece for The Tribe too, you know, it's like, are we expected to not play as rough as men? And are black women in particular, are we being held to a different standard?
Honestly, I hadn't been paying attention to this until The Tribe's article in response. And then I went over read The Tribe's editorial, and I was kind of like, why are you guys writing an editorial about basketball?
Yeah, yeah, that's why I was like, damn.
Caitlin Clark doesn't even play here.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of commentary, like even just some of the guys who do just sort of the halftime commentary in the NBA,
yes.
right? So
yes.
former players like Charles Barkley and the like, and there's just been a lot of discourse around Caitlin Clark, and a lot of protection as though she's this baby that needs to. Yes, she's a rookie, but there are several others.
There's several others.
She plays tough,
like you said. She is also a professional. She's playing against other professional women.
She knows what she's doing.
That game can get physical. There's another video making the rounds of her giving another player. I think it's an NCAA game. A good old shove
before
like,
she
the girl
around.
Goes to the ground. Yeah, and Caitlin's hands
it's
are on her hips.
Par for the
kind
course.
Of looks away. It is par for the course.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I had other thoughts. I forgot what they were, but I was just, it's a physical game.
No, it's a physical game.
I wonder though, maybe there is some double standard. There doesn't have to be, right? I was talking to my husband about this morning, follows sports more than I do. And I think one of the things that the Trib printed was that Charles Barkley, you know, the voice of common sense in sports, would think that's terrible.
Sure.
Kind of pointing out like, you know, oh, everybody in the league should be thanking her because of them. They finally got chartered jets and blah, 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 and getting all the things they need. The league should have been getting that stuff anyway.
Exactly.
And there are a whole bunch of women, and we can name their names too, Cheryl Swoops, Lisa Leslie, everybody else, who made the league what it is.
Exactly.
And Caitlin can still be an amazing player,
exactly.
right? And she is. She, you know, smashing all the records that she smashed, when you know, even men's records when she was playing in college ball. But I don't think she necessarily needs any more protection than any other player. And by the way, remember when the students were still all in college, Angel Reese talking about how tough her life had been since that championship win the year before through tears.
The tearful
Nobody's
press conference.
Nobody's editorial board was running to her rescue then.
No pity.
Exactly.
And now people are showing up at hotels where the Chicago Sky is staying at and threatening players.
Yeah.
Like, this
That's
is
ridiculous.
Getting out of hand, guys.
Ridiculous. Like, enough. All right, switching gears. Last week, we talked about private security patrolling the Fulton Market area. Now we're hearing about a new hotel that could be rolling into the neighborhood. I'm emphasizing rolling, Melody.
Yes, yes, because this building is the former site of a Schwinn bicycle factory in the late 1800s.
Okay.
People might know it now as Lake Street Lofts. It has been vacant for a while now. It was supposed to be turned into offices, but the developer who owns the site has seized a really good opportunity to instead convert it into a hotel, just because it is really expensive to build hotels right now.
Apparently.
So, yes. There's been many that have been announced in Fulton Market, just haven't come to fruition because it's expensive.
The money.
Yeah, but an adaptive reuse project like this will cost less. It'll take half the time for construction. And, you know, it will offer something new to Fulton Market, where hotel market is like pretty competitive right now.
Interesting. But it's not a done deal though, right? Like city council could still put the brakes on it.
Yes, it still needs to get approval through city council, but the developer has announced, hey, this is what I want to bring to you guys. So we'll see if it gets passed though.
All right, moving on to cicadas.
Gross.
No, really. The cicada news story. It's one that just keeps on giving, isn't it, folks?
Every time
it keeps on giving. I will say this, my 11-year-old, he ate one this morning.
No,
he cooked it and ate it. I kid you not. He cooked it first. Yeah, he's boiled it in some water.
I thought it was by mistake.
No. He's all about the cicadas.
Oh,
and
wow.
He cooked it and ate it. Well, you know, folks have been talking about
you can eat it.
And so he was like, he took a few bites. It's an acquired taste, he told me.
Yeah, no. Well, I want to talk today about zombie cicadas.
What? Oh, God, yes.
Yes.
Are they back from the dead?
Yeah, so it's all to do with an STD that, get this, it takes over the lower third of the cicada's body.
This just gets worse and
replacing
worse.
It with a fungus that somehow keeps them alive, flying around and attempting to mate. Has anybody seen this? The story just gets stranger and stranger.
Where did you find
this? It's so gross.
Like, what? With all the chatter about the trillions of cicadas that were taking over this summer, I mean, did any of us expect to be talking about zombie cicadas at this point?
No.
In the juncture.
Not so much.
I was like, is this where we turn into The Walking Dead? Like, is this how that starts? The cicadas?
They got STDs, first, but they're still
in the humans.
They're still trying to mate.
And yeah.
That's
still
disgusting.
I don't know.
I'm good.
Gross.
I'm glad
cicadas.
I live in the city.
Sit down. I live in the burbs.
Oh, my gosh. Well, before we go, we just got a few seconds here. I'm wondering what stories you guys have got cooking up for next week that you might want to tease. I'll start with you, Melody.
Man, I was hoping you weren't going to start with me. But, you know, I'm always on the DNC beat. So anything coming out of that, you know, you'll see my byline on
For sure. Brandis.
I'm going to be stealing all of their ideas. the stuff we do at Chicago Tonight's a little more long term. So I am actually working on a story about parole in Illinois and how it is complicated. We actually have mandatory supervised release for the most part. There are some instances of parole, but not the way most folks think about it. So I've got some stuff lined up on that.
Look out for
week.
That. Mm-hmm. And Mitch, what you working on?
The city council is expected to take up an ordinance, an ethics ordinance, actually, that would bar the mayor and mayoral candidates from taking campaign donations from lobbyists, which is not against the law, interestingly enough. So that would be quite a step for Chicago.
Well, look out for your story. We'll probably have you on the show. That's it for the news recap. My thanks to Mitch Armantrout of the Sun-Times, Block Club Chicago's Melody Mercado, and WTTW's Brandis Friedman. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Same to you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Max Lubers. The news never stops. And luckily, our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to take a pause and sift through it all in under an hour. So please consider leaving us a rating if you enjoy this recap as much as we do, because it helps more people find us. Thank you for listening and enjoy your weekend.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.